Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris. Welcome to The Future is Female. This is the show where we find the extraordinary in every woman. Now, I'm delighted to introduce my guest today. She is one of the world's leading anatomists and forensic anthropologists, Professor Dame Sue Black, Baroness Black of Strome, President of St. John's College at Oxford University. She's in town today at the invitation of Sunway Education's Inclusive Leadership Series, where she's just delivered a talk titled From Skeletons to Scholars, The Anatomy of Leadership. Now, Dame Sue was the lead anthropologist for the British forensic team's work in the war crimes investigations in Kosovo, and she's one of the first forensic scientists to travel to Thailand after the tsunami to provide assistance in identifying the dead. It's a pleasure to talk to her. Welcome to the show. Thank you for taking time.
Thank you very much for asking me. Thank you.
I am fascinated with the work that you are doing, and I'm curious to learn more about how you became interested in the field of forensic science. It's not every day someone says, I'm going to be a forensic scientist.
But you know, they do these days.
They do,
because there are the television programs. And so everybody looks at the CSI Kuala Lumpur or whatever it may be, and they think, that's what I want to do for a living. Mm. When I did this, there weren't those television programs. So I never knew there was a forensic world. So it's only, I think, as you get older, you get that chance to look back and you can see the pattern of how your life has developed.
So what was it for you?
For me, it was my father. I adored my father. He was the most gorgeous man on the planet. And I was his little shadow, and everywhere that he went, I followed him. And I'm sure I irritated him enormously.
Was he a forensic?
No, my father was a cabinet maker, an upholsterer, a French polisher. He created things with his hands. I mean, he was really an amazing craftsman. And he was also a very good shot. So, you know, we lived rurally, and so he would shoot pigeons and rabbits and those sorts of things, and I would go with him. And so I learned very early on that I'd carry the dead rabbits home and I'd sit at the back door with him and I'd learn how to skin a rabbit. So from a very early age, death was something that always felt very natural to me. And his mother, my grandmother, she was very, very comfortable with the concept of death. And she would talk to me about it. She had that wonderful ability that some people have to talk to you at your age. She never talked down to you. Mm. She talked at you at the same age, which was just wonderful. And she believed in a life after this one. And she would talk about that death was your friend because it walked alongside you every moment of your life. And eventually your paths would cross, so make death your friend. And we would have long discussions about what death meant. And I can remember her saying to me when I was very young, when your father dies, you need to be with him, because he won't want to be on his own. And that stayed with me all the way through until my father did die and I was with him. So that concept of death that I think in a modern world that we shy away from, because I think we feel uncomfortable with death, it's almost as if we talk about it, it encourages it.
Right.
I didn't grow up with that at all. Death for me was as normal as birth. It was normal as waking up every day. And so getting into the world of anatomy, which is about cadavers and relies totally on individuals who bequeath their bodies for dissection. Mm. That's all about death.
Right.
So going into a mortuary in a forensic world was just very natural.
So the forensic anthropologists look at who has died, how they died, when they died, all those things. Maybe you can explain to those who are not fans of CSI or other forensic TV shows.
Dreadful program.
What does it entail?
So there's two words in there. Mm. The first word is the forensic bit, which is not terribly important. All that means is it comes from the Latin word forensis, which means pertaining to the forum. And the forum were the precursors of the courts of Rome. So anything that has the word forensic means you're an expert into the courtroom.
Oh.
I'm an anthropologist. I'm an anatomist, but anthropologist. So the only forensic bit is my expertise goes into the courtroom. And my job as an anthropologist is not about a cause of death or a manner of death. That's the pathologist who does that. The anthropologist is interested in who was this person when they were alive. It's about identity. So we get called in when the identity of the individual is in question. We don't know who they are. And we will help the pathologist, who might be trying to establish what is the manner of the cause of death. We'll help them get to that conclusion. But our job is really about, is this a human? Mm-hmm. How long has the human been dead? Because in our country, if you've been dead for more than 70 years, you're actually archaeological, you're not forensic. So is it human? How long has it been dead? And who was that person when they were alive? That's our job.
Who was that person
when they were alive?
It's really interesting.
It's really important, because if you imagine you have a body and you don't know who that individual was, your investigation around their death really is limited, because you can't go and talk to family, you can't talk to friends, you can't check their mobile phone, you can't go and look at their bank account. You don't know who they are, so you can't get the information about them. And if you don't know who they are, you can't hand the body back to families. So that identification is really important. Now, most of us will die where we expect to die. Yeah. We'll die in a hospital, or we'll die in our homes, or in a car crash, and people will know it's us. But every now and again, perhaps where you have a mass fatality event, we have to be able to separate individuals. Or if bodies are found decomposed, who was that person when they were alive?
That must leave you with so many... That must be such a fulfilling part of your work, to discover who this person was. I mean, you must have so many stories learning about each individual person and the history. Are there some that stay in your mind?
Oh, always. But there are two really important things in what you've just asked. The first one is, you know, why do we do this? Mm. One is about justice. So if we can identify who the individual is, we can ask the questions then, has something untoward happened to them? Mm. Is somebody responsible? Can somebody be brought to justice? So justice is an important part of what we do. The other is humanitarian. So it's about saying, if we can identify who this person was, then we can hand them back to their family. And when a family has somebody missing, they talk about their life going into a stutter. They can't sort of move forward. And when we bring the news, I'm sorry, it is your son, it is your mother, it's always bad news, but it's news that has a kindness, because it's allowing you then to know what's happened and to move on in life. So we operate at two quite different levels.
Can I ask you about your experience in Kosovo? So 1999, leading the British forensic team's work in the war crime investigations. Talk to me a little bit about the kind of work that you were doing. And I think many of us are so far removed as to war crime investigations. What does a forensic anthropologist do at a site, at a war crime investigation site?
Well, to give you the best example of that, I had no intentions of being involved in the war crimes investigation. I never expected to be. But it was the very first site that the team turned up to that the pathologist said, I can't do this. I need an anthropologist. I'm going to phone Sue. And so I got a phone call on a Wednesday afternoon to say, what are you doing on Saturday? And he meant, can I fly out to Kosovo? And so it was literally based on a phone call. And what we had was, we had an outhouse. And that outhouse was on the main route going from Prizren, which is a major city in Kosovo, down towards the Albanian border. And the refugees were heading in that direction. 44 men were taken off that train and taken to this outhouse. They were separated into two rooms, and a gunman stood at the door of each room and sprayed it with Kalashnikov fire, killed everybody except one. And he was the person who was in the corner of the room, because all the bodies in front just shielded him from the bullets. What they then did was they threw in straw, they threw in petrol, and they torched the building. So this man who's a witness is lying underneath the bodies of the dead and burning people that he knew. And he knows he can't come out, because if he comes out, he'll be shot. And so he has to stay there. I mean, very traumatized man, but a really important witness. Because we are there because the International Criminal Court has said, these incidents we're seeing, we don't believe they are combat. So right. They're not military groups in combat. This is targeting civilians. And if you're targeting civilians, then that is a war crime. So it's not within the Geneva Conventions. Mm-hmm. And if it's a war crime, then somebody needs to be brought to justice for that. It may be the person who shot the gun. It may be the officer that gave the command for that gun to be shot. It may be that it came from a government minister, or it may come right from the top, which is the president of the country. So we're collecting evidence. Sometimes it's just a bullet that we pull out of a piece of plaster in a wall. And if we can link that bullet to a gun, we might know which soldier had that gun, which commanding officer gave him the instructions, what was his commanding officer. And so you go up the chain of evidence. And every small piece that you look at becomes incredibly important, because you don't know which one will give you that solid chain of evidence all the way to the top. And that's what we got to with Milosevic and Karadzic and Mladic and the other senior officers, is they were finally brought to justice in the courts. Although, of course, Milosevic died before there was verdict, which for the gentleman in the case that I talked about was a great sadness, because he wanted to give evidence and was never allowed to because Milosevic died.
How do you feel when your work ends up in these international cases?
You in many ways have to pretend it's not yours. Okay. And the reason I say that is that we have a specific job, and we have to focus on that job, and we have not to be distracted by anything else. So we're not there to investigate the crimes. We're not there to find somebody guilty. We're there as forensic scientists to say, where's the evidence? How do I retrieve the evidence? How do I interpret that evidence? And how do I present it to the lawyers who can present it to the court? Right. The court will determine justice. The investigators will find the evidence. We're just that little bit in the middle. And it's a great sense of achievement, but you know you've only been a small part in it. You're not the person who made that big difference. You were just a cog in that wheel.
Right.
And that teamwork is what's incredibly important.
But you're also, as a forensic anthropologist, bearing witness to what happened, even if it's post the fact. How do you, in your work, I'm just wondering what it's taught you about humanity, the capacity of men, the evils that men are capable of, and how you stop yourself from having a crisis of faith in humanity, if you've ever had a crisis of faith in humanity.
No, never. And the reason I've never had a crisis of faith is when you stand at a graveside with somebody who has lost everything, and by that I mean not just their home and their belongings, they've lost their entire family, and you are exhuming those remains. That person standing next to you, every time, unfailingly, has always had such a spark of brilliant humanity in them that it's humbling. They will say, can I get you a glass of water? Can I bring you a cup of coffee? They have gone through immeasurable things, but they still think about putting you first. That, for me, is what humanity is about, and you never lose sight of that. But I can remember sitting on the Macedonian border and a journalist saying to me, don't you find this dispiriting, that so soon after the Second World War, we're seeing the same thing happen again? And I said, well, wherever you have a despotic leader who does not have any value in humanity, then you can expect these things to happen. And a journalist asked me not that long ago, aren't you surprised when you see what's happening in Ukraine so soon after what happened in Kosovo? The answer is the same. So you will always get individuals in the world who will choose to exploit others. And if they're not curtailed, you end up in these atrocious war crime situations. It is human nature. It's the poor side of human nature. But there's the converse, which is there is great, great kindness in humanity and those who suffer.
But because you have been you've been part of an investigation to war crimes, you've seen the atrocities of war, how do you feel when you see it happening in real time, in today's world? When you see war happening, when you see what men are capable of and the pain inflicted on others,
There is an element where when I was more active in the forensic world, you would watch the news and you'd think, oh, there's my next job. You know, so it was that's where I'm going next. When the Asian tsunami occurred, my husband turned to me and he said, yeah, I know, go and pack your suitcase, you're going.
Without saying
and
a
I did.
Word,
he knew it, and that's exactly what I did. So you view the news as, I'm going to be needed.
Right.
My expertise is going to be needed. It's not me, it's my expertise that's needed.
I've got a job to do.
I need to go and do it. You're not important as a person, you're important as a set of skills. And that's what I've always said when government wants to put us into places, is the skill set that you have in a forensic team is hugely valuable, because it takes decades to develop. You don't put them into a crime scene where there's risk, because you can't afford to lose that team. So we have to look after ourselves, right, as well as everything else.
Okay. Well, you mentioned twofold, justice and humanitarian, as the reason for your work. I'm wondering how forensic science helps tackle gender-based violence, helps survivors of gender-based violence seek justice. Have you had experience with that?
So it's very difficult to know whether the case that you're involved in at the time is going to be about gender violence. You don't know sometimes.
Okay.
Because you may have a body, but you don't know what has occurred in that. Mm. Where I became, started doing an awful lot of work in relation to research was child sexual abuse. And in child sexual abuse, unquestionably, the predominant perpetrator is male, mm-hmm. but not exclusively, but it is predominantly male. And the victim is predominantly female. So in something like child sex abuse, but again, not exclusively, mm-hmm. it is very much a case of gender violence and abuse. Mm-hmm. And that came about very simply in relation to a case that I was asked to look at. And it was a young girl who alleged that every night her father would come into her bedroom and abuse her. And she was a teenage girl. And she told her mother, and her mother didn't believe her. They were from a background where you didn't question the paternal strength in the family. And what this young girl did, teenage girl, she popped on the camera on her computer, and she recorded herself being abused. So she knew she would be abused again, and she wanted to record it, which I just find, it puts the hair up on the back of my neck. It
so
really does.
Brave.
It's incredibly brave and foresight. So it happened, mm-hmm. and she took that video to the police and said, this is happening to me and it's my father. And what you saw in the video at 4:30 in the morning was just a hand and a forearm coming into the field of vision. And that's undoing what she said was happening to her. You never see a face. And so the police said, well, what are we supposed to do with that? And I said, well, I have no idea, but let me have a look at it. And what we found is when your camera is turned on in your computer, at night it goes into near-infrared mode. And so you can see in the dark. And so you see this hand in the dark. And when near-infrared interacts with the deoxygenated blood that's in your veins, stands out like black tram lines.
Your veins?
Yes. So we could see the pattern of veins on the back of the hand and on the back of the forearm. Now, we know in anatomy that they're variable. And if you look at the pattern of veins on the back of your right hand, your left hand, they'll be different. Sometimes it's easier to see them on your
right.
wrist.
Yes.
But they're different. Your right and your left side are not symmetrical. Oh. If you're an identical twin, they're different. If it's your mom and dad's, they're different.
Is it
your pattern.
Unique to the individual?
We think so. We haven't got to that point
okay.
yet with science, but we know it is a pattern that is most likely yours and possibly nobody else's, because they form when you're a fetus inside your mum and they don't change. So we knew that from anatomy, and we also knew that in the research world, in biometrics, there was a lot of work going on in vein pattern recognition and biometrics, particularly for gaining access into high security places.
Oh.
And so we could bring them both together and say, well, we know veins are variable. So what I can do is I can compare the perpetrator in the video and I can compare dad. And if those two don't match, it's not him.
You can, yes.
I can exclude him. 100% certainty, it won't be him. But if they match, I don't know what that means, because I don't know what the prevalence of that particular pattern is. We'd not done the research.
Did they match?
Well, they did match. And so I thought, well, I don't know what that means. So they took it to the lawyers, and the lawyer said, well, let's investigate it in the courtroom. And so I took the evidence into the courtroom, and the judge allowed me to present the evidence, which was the first time it had ever been given in a UK court. And the jury went out, and the jury came back, and the jury found Dad not guilty. And I said to the barrister, what did I do wrong? How could I not convince the jury? And she said, you didn't do anything wrong. There was nothing wrong with your evidence at all. They didn't believe the girl, because she didn't break down and she didn't cry. Now, this was a young girl who had, you know, endured, I don't know how long in terms of abuse, had been disbelieved by her mother, had recorded it so she could prove it was happened, had taken it to the police. She was a young woman who you know, was stoic, is probably the best way to describe her. And so she was in control of her emotions. Because she wasn't, they didn't believe her. And I always felt at that point, science needed to be further on. Maybe if we'd been further on, we could have helped her that day, because he will have been released back into the family home because he's found not guilty, and who knows what may have happened to her. So science can, in the most unexpected places, play a role in identifying perpetrators of crime that are frequently about gender violence. And certainly in child abuse, that's a very major area.
Do you know what happened to her?
I don't. And, you know, you could surmise, you know, if when Dad was released back into the family, maybe the abuse stopped, maybe that was enough to scare him. Maybe it didn't happen. Maybe it continued. Maybe she ran away from home. Maybe she was on the streets. Maybe she was taken in by an aunt. We don't know. Okay. If she was on the streets, did she enter prostitution? Was she in drugs? Is she still alive? Mm. I don't know. But I know her name, and very few other people do. And I keep telling her story in the hope that one day she'll hear it. And she'll come to me and say, my name is, and I'll know it's her. And then I can say to her, this research that we have done now that has secured over 30 life sentences and over 500 years of prison sentencing is her legacy. It's not ours. It's her. She was a brave, brave young woman as a teenager, and we couldn't help her that day, but she has helped so many others in terms of justice to be brought to bear.
What a story. I hope she finds you.
I hope she does.
I hope she finds you. In the couple of minutes that we have left, I do want to ask you about the field of forensic science, and how it has changed since you first entered it, in terms of gender representation, in terms of diversity and equality and equity. Has it moved to the better? And I think a lot of people always assume that it's a male-dominated field.
Yeah.
Is that so?
So when I started, because I'm very old, it was a long time ago. No, it is. It was before we used DNA in the forensic world. So in the 1980s, 1984, Alec Jeffries did his experiments that he couldn't get to work. And he was pulling his hair out because he couldn't get them to work. And that was when he realized it was because everybody's DNA was different. And the forensic world then just exploded from that point forward. So my first cases were in the 80s. So before there was any real sort of science that you would use in the genetics. So it was very fledgling. And in the country, there was no such thing as forensic anthropology. I was an anatomist that was then being asked to help the police. Only really, I think, when we got into the 1990s, did we start to see forensic anthropology developing as a discipline. And that was largely as a result of the war crimes investigations, the mass fatality events, what was happening in Argentina with the missing, Guatemala with the missing, all of these places around the world were realizing that when bodies are decomposed or fragmented, it's a different skill set that's required. So it became much more mainstream, and that's when you start to find courses developing on forensic anthropology and those sorts of things. So it's changed in terms of the science, but it's also changed, I think, in terms of the wider acceptance of the subject. What I find interesting about it is that almost overwhelmingly, forensic scientists are female. So there's a huge preponderance of females. Forensic anthropology in my field, when we had our honours year, they were 100% female. If we got a young man into the room, we celebrated because it was all women.
Why is that?
I don't know. I don't know whether it's the investigative nature of it, whether it's the humanitarian bit of it, whether it's because it's very biology-based and women are more likely to be biologically focused. Whether that attracts them, I don't know. But we often talk about science having a leaky pipeline for women. Yes. You come in and then you drop out along the way.
Right.
But we don't have that in forensic science. Women are just as likely to go to the top as men. And so many of the laboratories around the world in forensic science are led by women.
That's excellent.
So it's great. I don't know whether it's we didn't have a glass ceiling. And so it's such a new subject in that regard that it just feels there's no gender difference in there.
All right. So do you get a lot of young women, young men who come to you and say, I want to be in this field? Or is it still considered sort of left field?
So it's still left field, but there are so many forensic programs on the television.
Do you think that's helped or hurt?
I think it's helped and hurt.
The profession.
Yeah, it's certainly raised the profile.
Yes.
What it's not helped us with is the reality of the situation, because people think it's all gleaming, you know, stainless steel mortuaries and everybody looks terribly glamorous. That is so not the way
in
it goes.
The stiff white coats.
Yeah, no, it's not like that at all. So there's an unrealistic expectation, but people will come forward and say, I want to be a forensic scientist. And my advice is always, out of those two words, forensic science, there's only one word that's important, and that's the science. Mm. So be a scientist first. Be a biologist, a chemist, a physicist, a mathematician, whatever the science is. And then when you're an expert in that, that's when you'll apply it in the courtroom, because that's when you become forensic. But be the scientist first.
Thank you so much for speaking with me. It's such a pleasure to
talk
to you.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
That's all we have for you on this episode of The Future is Female. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching. Good night.